Your name?
Brian Anders.
Brian Anders, we're standing beside La Casa Shelter, which the Washington Post is reporting that it's closing down. Let me just start by asking your thoughts on that.
Well, I can remember when the shelter was opened in the late 80s. And it's going to be a loss to this community. One, this is the last emergency shelter in Columbia Heights. It's the only bilingual shelter that not only shelters the homeless, but it also provides mental health care and drug treatment. And it's a low barrier drug treatment program that that serves on average 75 men in a 6-month program that give them the opportunity to turn their lives around. It's a low barrier program, and it's very open to helping folks to overcome homelessness, help them with extended programs to get people jobs and housing placement and that sort of thing. So not only is it a loss as an emergency shelter, it's also is a loss as a resource for people who are trying to improve the quality of their lives.
Can you describe Columbia Heights? This is a gentrified neighborhood.
Well, I've lived in this neighborhood off and on last 12, 14 years. And what you have in this neighborhood now is a clear division of wealth between the wealthier folks who are living in these nice high rises, renovated townhouses, neighborhoods now where you see fences and iron gates where at one time you were able to just cross from one person's lawn to another lawn. You could talk to your neighbors on your front porch. Now you go around in this neighborhood, you see people with these ornate fountains in their yards, big statues. And you see that the neighborhood is changing, but it's not changing for the people that live here. It's changing to invite new folks to come into the district. People with higher incomes, supposedly better educated. And in a way, it's kind of saying to the people who have been born in this neighborhood and raised in this neighborhood, you don't belong here anymore. There's no place for you here. And so I see them closing a La Casa shelter, which has been been at risk of being closed since 2002, has just another way to remove a population that's unwanted in this community. And sadly, the city, Councilman Jim Graham and former head of DHS under Anthony Williams, Carolyn Graham, made an agreement with the men who lived in this shelter in 2002 to dismantle these trailers, move them into another safe location, and renovate this building and turn it into a multi-service shelter that would not only transition people from the streets into treatment, but would help them with employment, mental health care, for the folks who are undocumented. I mean, there was all sorts of potential if those agreements have been followed upon. But in Washington in general, you just see that there's a rush to displace shelters out of the downtown area, like the Franklin Shelter, this one here in Columbia Heights. And they're just pushing people further and further away from the business corridor. In my head, the rationale is out of sight and out of mind. If you don't see poor people, you don't know poor people exist. If you don't see homeless people in your community, you assume that they don't exist. You assume that people are being taken care of because the Post reports that all these people are getting apartments. But the reality is the people who are getting apartments in the shelters are not who this housing is designed for. That housing in Housing First was specifically designated for people who are chronically homeless, people who have severe mental illness, who have been homeless for more than 10, 12 years, folks who have extreme problems with hygiene, mental health, long-term substance abusers. Housing First is now being used to help with this idea of clearing out these neighborhoods by shutting down emergency shelters, and where some folks are going to get into these apartments and do better and thrive. What I've discovered is a lot of these folks you put in these apartments and they're not able to interact with each other on a regular basis, communicate about different issues affecting them. It kind of creates a different kind of warehousing. And folks feel more isolated in these apartments than the ones that I've talked to. They feel like they're in neighborhoods where they're not comfortable. They're also, some of these folks are in neighborhoods that are more dangerous than the shelters that they left. You're finding in a lot of cases in some of the buildings where folks live in, there's drug use that occurs. People say that they're not seeing the wraparound services that they're promised. So there are all sorts of problems with Housing First. But again, the whole purpose of Housing First and the whole purpose of getting rid of La Casa is to just bury these social problems like poverty, homelessness, substance abuse, domestic violence. And we don't want to address these social issues to any real degree. What we want to do is just hide the problem away, build nice, big, pretty buildings, build big condos, build this mall like the mall across the street from the shelter, and give people the impression that there's all this prosperity in D.C., that people are doing well, that the national poverty that's affecting everyone in the United States isn't happening in the nation's capital, which obviously isn't true, since we had a study a week ago that came out and said that one in every three children in D.C. is living in poverty. So
43% of African-American children are living in poverty. If I'm not mistaken, the Housing First program was rolled out in conjunction with the closure of Franklin Shelter. And we've just come up on the two-year anniversary of that. And the line then seems to be the line now, which is, well, we're going to house the people who are at the shelter. Well, it turns out that wasn't the case with Franklin. And who knows how well that'll be the case here. But can you talk about the need to not think it's one or the other? It's not a shelter or Housing First, but the fact that we need shelters, which don't just serve the people in it at any one time, but serve many, many more people through the course of the months and the years. And so that we need both shelters and apartments for people to move into their own living quarters.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because what you're seeing in D.C. is an increase of homelessness, whether it's single individuals. The rising population of homeless in their district right now are homeless families. So there is always going to be some sort of need for emergency shelter. The idea that you're going to create apartments that are going to be subsidized by city funds when the city is already $117 million in arrears, and you're going to be able to find enough public or enough affordable housing or enough rental housing for all these families while the numbers are continuing to increase, while at the same time ignoring the population of people who are already currently homeless in the district, it's kind of some weird, bizarre thinking that if you tell people that the sky is purple, and you tell them the sky is purple, and you tell them the sky is purple, and you tell them that time and time and time and time again, people will stop looking up to see if it's blue because they believe the story that you're telling them. The reality is that you need both. You need permanent supportive housing for folks who can function, who are higher functioning, who can live in that housing, maintain it, take care of it, and increase and improve their quality of life. But for those folks who are always falling through the cracks, especially with the dismantling of the social service net, you are always going to have that population of people who, when the weather gets bad, like on a day that's cold and wet and rainy and windy and drizzly, who are going to need some place to be inside, who are going to need a place where they can just lay their head and not have to worry about rules and regulations or taking medication. You know, that you're always going to have poor people in this country. You're always going to have homeless people in this country. So the idea that if we say we're putting you in housing, we dismantle the emergency shelter system, is kind of, it's penny wise and pound foolish. You at some point you're going to need these beds that you're going to lose here. These 90 beds that are gone are never going to be replaced. And on average now we're seeing at least 40, 50, 60 more families who are going to emergency shelters looking for emergency shelter. We have 135 to 200 families at DC General that are being warehoused there. And no one's talking about those folks getting permanent housing. So we're going to create some sort of system where if we don't give you an apartment, we'll just hide you out in some empty public building somewhere. We won't talk about the fact that we're hiding you out there somewhere. We won't provide the services that you need to move out of those situations. And we'll just continue to ignore the fact that in every quadrant of the District of Columbia where homeless people are present, there needs to be an access to emergency shelter, especially when we have these extreme cold weather, cold winters, and the extreme heat in the summertime. Because more people who are homeless die of heat exposure than they do of freezing to death and hypothermia.
Can you talk about one of the lines of the Washington Post article from October 1st about this shelter closing is, quote, "But the La Casa shelter is mourned by few, including many who frequented it," end quote. And the point is, the shelter, as we look at it, you know, at these trailers, it's not in good shape. Can you talk about the lack of investment into these shelters, and then the government steps in not to put resources in, not to make them places where people can really take the next step in their life, but degrade them and then to step in, and then the next step is to close them because they have been ignored for so long?
Well, again, if you looked at these office trailers, this was a temporary idea that came out of the Housing Now march that the Community for Creative Nonviolence with the National Coalition for the Homeless helped to coordinate in 1989. A gentleman in Ohio put these temporary office shelter trailers together that are normally out of job sites and used as temporary offices, renovated them, and made 18-bed emergency shelters where folks in a crisis situation, like say a flood, hurricane, that sort of thing, would have a temporary but fixed structure in a location where people could be housed, have showers, some place where they could eat, you know, minimum of services. But that was in 1988, 1989. So we're talking almost 30 years that we've been using these temporary structures that have literally fallen apart around the folks. And no provision has been made to take the building, the prison, the building where La Casa houses this drug program, and to improve the quality in there, build upon this site, and create a very simple four-tiered system where people are coming in off the streets. If you need drug treatment, it's available. If you need mental health care, it's available. And making those kinds of services available on site so people aren't having to bounce all across the city to get these small little pieces of the puzzle that they need to move on, move forward. And what it seems to me like, buildings like this one have been allowed to fall into disrepair for the simple reason that when you talk about closing them, the reason you get no resistance from the residents is these buildings are in such bad shape, either with leaks, bad plumbing, bad toilet facilities, that, oh yeah, anything that you give offer to me, even living back on the street, would be better than living in this trailer that's literally falling around my head. But what is more concerning to me about the La Casa shelter is that when I worked in this neighborhood as the advocacy and outreach coordinator with Neighbors Consejo, we worked with the men in this shelter to encourage them to approach the city government, to fight for them, to fight to not only maintain the drug program while it was here, but to work in concert with the city to help them to design the kind of shelter that they wanted. And they have written agreements with a city councilman and with a deputy mayor who was at that time the head of human services. So you have a signed document, you have all these agreements, you had men who testified before the city council for months, you had people who were willing to put themselves at risk of losing their beds because they spoke out about the conditions in the shelter. And you have city government officials who make agreements with you and say that, yes, your input is valuable. Yes, we hear your concerns. Yes, we will work with you. And you can sign a document. You can sign it and do a big public press conference about it. But that was done in 2002. Here it is, 2010. These buildings have been allowed to continue to deteriorate. They've reduced the population in this building by removing beds on a monthly basis, so the numbers of people coming in here were reduced because they weren't enough space to serve them.
Same thing they did with Franklin Shelter.
Exactly, and they were transporting people through the hypothermia hotline and bouncing them out to shelters out like 801 in Southeast and the New York Avenue shelter, and pretty much been using subtle fear, forcing some of these folks to take these apartments, not knowing where the neighborhoods they were going to be in, where they were going to be relocated, while with a little bit of work, some community investment, allowing some of the men with the skills necessary to help renovate these buildings, these buildings could have been turned into something that were assets to the community. These buildings could have been used as an example of how this city treats its homeless. And we could begin the process of having real dialogue about the issue, the social irresponsibility of the government in terms of how it creates poverty, how it ignores people that it impoverishes. And we wouldn't be facing a situation where we're going to lose 90 beds, where because the Washington Post says these 90 folks are going to get housing, we're going to believe that these folks are going to get housing, we're going to hope that they're going to get housing. But for those folks that don't get apartments, especially for the Spanish-speaking population who are comfortable in this neighborhood, who know all the ins and outs in this neighborhood, they know where to get services, they know where to get food, most of those folks are going to fall through the cracks, and they're going to end up sleeping out here by either the subway station, by the mall here, in the parking garage, and that empty lot by where Bell Multicultural School used to be. And it's ironic because I think in 1998, we had a homeless man who was a resident of the shelter who froze to death on the ground, 10 feet from the entryway, in one of the most extreme winters we had. A woman who froze to death in front of the Mount Pleasant Library in the middle of winter, in a spot where she was visible to people walking past her, and a third homeless person in that one same week who froze to death on the steps of the Scottish Rite Temple at 16th and Columbia Road. I think this winter, if it's as extreme as the last winters we've had, you're going to find a number of these people are going to be in the streets. We're going to start finding their bodies again. We're going to find them dead. And because the Post doesn't do anything that even equals anything around investigative reporting, these folks will die of hypothermia. We won't hear about it publicly. We won't know their names. We won't know their circumstances. We won't know the disposition of their bodies. And this issue of homelessness will, again, be pushed under the rug. We'll just go with the sound bites about what the mayor's administration is doing, how wonderful it is that he's eliminating homelessness, and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that more people and more people and more people who are coming out in the streets are going to begin to find less resources. They're going to find less emergency shelter beds. And it's criminal that in the nation's capital, the most powerful city on the planet, this idea that homelessness is being eliminated, when you can walk out of any downtown building anywhere on K Street and see any numbers of homeless people in McPherson Square, in Franklin Park, Farragut North Park, anywhere in downtown area, DuPont Circle, that there's just no sense of real compassion or any sense that the city is willing to address this issue in a way that works with the homeless folks, gives them voice, listens to what they want, and gives them the kind of shelter that they need that moves people forward. It's just criminal. It's a shame.
Brian Anders, I just want to revisit this one point, which is decision makers again and again will say, well, we're going to give people housing, and housing is better than shelter. And that's hard to argue with. But the point about a shelter serving so many more people than just at one time. So even if all 90 individuals who slept here and are still, I guess, still sleeping here in some numbers at these trailers at La Casa are given their own apartments, the numbers of people who would be served if this place stayed is far, far, far more than 90.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this shelter on average houses anywhere between 125 to 220 men. So even if these 90 men are all giving housing, there are still going to be numbers of folks in this community who only use the shelters in the extreme weather, you know, during the winter when it's temporary, who are going to be coming to someplace in this area looking for someplace to sleep that's warm and it's safe. And it's, this place is not going to be here. And no other building is going to be opened in this community to serve the needs of those folks. So in some ways, and this kind of might be a little too harsh to say, but when you look at people like Tommy Wells, who's the head of the Human Services Committee, who is completely clueless about what's really going on with homelessness, and he has no interest in knowing what's going on. And you look at the new administration coming in, who's making all these grandiose promises about how he's going to change things and unify the city.
And he was the head of Human Services.
He was the head of Human Services.
Talking about Vincent Gray.
Yes, and he was the head of Human Services under Sharon Pratt Kelly, and he was one of the people that made draconia cuts that began to affect the way the city dealt with the homeless. I really believe that it's criminal. And if some way, if we had a just judicial system, these people should be held liable for every human person in this city that dies, that it, that their drug treatment is neglected, that their mental health care is neglected. They should be criminally held responsible for any time that we find a body in the street, any time someone here is going hungry unnecessarily, because those are the people that make the decisions on how the money is spent. They make the decisions on what shelters are closed. They make the decisions on how human services resources are developed and spread around, out across the city. But more importantly, the bottom line is closing of these shelters is less an issue about humanity and being compassionate to people. These are business decisions. And most of these business decisions are not made by city government. They're made by people like the Donatellis, the downtown bid, which was critical in the closing of the Franklin shelter. In fact, their outreach coordinator specifically said in a meeting that he and his group were the ones that approached Mayor Fenty and said, shut that building down. That's a beautiful building. It's too expensive. It's in too nice a location to be used as an emergency shelter after the city had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars putting in a heating system and an air conditioning system, trying to bring in social services, trying to bring in mental health care. The business community can come to anybody in the city council or in the mayor's office and say, basically, we want that property for development. We don't care about the people who are sleeping there. We don't care about how much money you wasted on those folks. We don't care what happens to them. Just tell the Washington Post they're going to get housing. Just tell the community we're going to put them in shelters. Nobody does any follow through. There's no investigative reporting. People go into the streets, and there's just no sense of what are the real outcomes for these folks once we lose track of them. I mean, some of these folks, like I say, I am not against people getting housing. I am all for every person in the streets. Every person who needs an affordable housing unit should be able to have affordable housing in the District of Columbia. I am all for that. But there's ways to transition people into housing. There are ways to work with your population where I don't take away the little bit of safety net, the little bit of security you have on the promise that I'm going to give you a better life somewhere down the road. We are going to always need these stopgap measures like emergency shelters. I don't care what any expert says. I've read all sorts of reports about how great Housing First is across the country. At the same time, I'm looking at stories across the internet where tent cities are popping up all across the United States. I can drive anywhere around D.C. and still see people sleeping under bridges, still see people sleeping in doorways. Anywhere up and down K Street between 14th and K and Georgetown, you're going to count hundreds of people. If you went to Union Station today, there's 70-some-odd people that stay in and outside of Union Station. So not only do we not have a real handle on what to do about the homeless population, there is no will, no compassion, no concern, no critical thinking, and basic just general inquisitiveness from somebody from DC government would make you want to think, hey, there's all these folks sleeping outside. We got to do better by our homeless population. But those kinds of questions never get asked. The Washington Post is not going to ask them, obviously. And now with this new population of folks who are coming here to basically take control of the District of Columbia, using their money to do so, there's going to be less and less concerned about how people are who are impoverished and who are poor. And our homeless population will just be another one of those populations of folks that we just consider throwaway people, people that just don't matter because they don't have any money, they have no voice. And the advocacy community, unfortunately, is just as culpable in allowing this to happen, because some of these groups get their funding from the business community, they get their funding from the city. You have a lot of these ad hoc people who will get quoted in the Post as calling themselves advocates. But when we have hundreds of public buildings that are open and empty, there doesn't seem to be any kind of push to go in there and take over these buildings, work with the homeless folks themselves, organize them, and go over and take over these, some of these abandoned firehouses or public school buildings that have been closed down under the Fenty, with Mr. Fenty and through Chairman Ree's time in the with the school board, and make and create the situation where you're forcing the city to acknowledge that there is a problem here. And that could be done with a minimum amount of work and organization, but it's more important, from in my opinion, for a lot of these advocates to continue to complain about the problems instead of listening to what the homeless want, working to organize the homeless folks and giving them the opportunity to say, hey, if you give me a chance I would rather live in a building and break into a building and have a safe place to stay than live on the streets. There's just no words to describe the frustration and pain that you feel. I mean, I've worked with the homeless in the city for almost 25 years, and this is the worst I've seen in turnaround from a city of people that were compassionate and a caring government to a government of people who are just basically collecting their paychecks and not doing their jobs.
Ryan Anders, Donatelli and Klein is the owners of this plot here where La Casa Shelter is. I went into the luxury apartments next door and I asked who owns it, and that's Donatelli and Klein. And I don't know if it's this particular building, but recently they got millions of dollars in tax breaks because they had built luxury condos, I'm sure with TIFs, tax incremental financing, and they said, well, the condo market is bad, we need to convert to apartments, and now we need another tax break, and they got that to the tune, I can't remember of how many, it was more than $10 million. Can you talk about Donatelli and Klein and the emphasis that this city places on making sure that even when a businessman makes a bad decision, he's getting bailed out, but here, we can't invest, you know, the resources and people to help bail them out of their situation?
Oh, Lord. I would not only just say it's the Donatellis of the world and the Kleins of the world. I just think that the people whose voices get heard are the people who have the money. And since most of these developers, and ironically, none of them live in the District of Columbia, don't pay any property taxes here, had the benefit of having a lot of friends in the Wilson building, whether it's Adrian Fenty or now Vincent Gray, the possible new mayor-elect coming in November, you're starting to see all those same people who ran in, who were behind Adrian Fenty, all those millionaires who gave millions of dollars to his reelection campaign, are now moving back into the Wilson building, going right back at the next potential mayor, going back to members of the city council, going back to Chairman Kwame Brown, and basically offering them whatever they want in terms of financial support, so that they can get these big tens of millions of dollars of tax breaks to continue to build these opulent buildings, to build these monuments to themselves, basically. And understanding that the housing market nationally is falling apart, it makes no sense to continue to build housing that people can't afford. I mean, this city has a glut, I think, of around anywhere between 7,800 to 9,000 empty condominiums that some of them have been converted to apartments because they couldn't sell as condos. And like you say, developers get big tax breaks. But when you had the key to the candy store, and if your city council member is the person who was running the cash register, of course you're going to get whatever you want. You're going to walk in there, you're going to pick up a $50 bag of candy, and you're going to walk out paying maybe 75 cents. I mean, I know that's a strange way to look at it, but these folks have access to power. And those are the folks that people listen to. Homeless people, nobody cares about what happens to the homeless. I mean, homelessness has become a business. And it's become a profitable business for a lot of some of these non-for-profits. And if these homeless folks were worth a quarter of the amount of money that Chris Donatelli was worth, oh, somebody would pay attention to where they live. They would care how people live. They would be living in nicer buildings. They would have any myriad of services that they needed, that they asked for, anything that they wanted. But because these are people at the bottom, and unfortunately, it's the majority of people who are at the bottom, nobody cares that people are poor. Nobody wants to hear about people being impoverished. Nobody wants to talk about renovating buildings and being humane, because it's just not cost effective. There is, I mean, no homeless folks are going to be able to say, hey, Mr. Gray, I'm going to be able to give you $1,000 towards your reelection campaign. Hey, Mr. Gray, I can go and have a big party for you and raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for your campaign. Or to Kwame Brown and go and say, hey, Mr. Brown, you know, glad to see you're a chairman of the council. Know you have a lot of sway over who gets what committee. And those decisions are also made based on who can best just fill those coffers with money or fill their pockets with money. So homeless folks are never going to have the opportunity to have a seat at the table, because there's not even a place for them or a building for them to come into where the table even exists. So, I mean, I think we're, you know, the situation in the city where, you know, the haves are getting everything and the have-nots are getting nothing, is that gap is going to continue to increase. We're beginning to see the erosion of the black middle class and the working class in this city. I think it's kind of frightening to see that. I think until you have a mass number of people that either die in the streets, or like what happened to DC General, they finally got attention to the families. You have people's children who are, you know, newborns who die, that this is going to continue, that people are not going to be concerned because they're going to read it in the Post that everything is okay. And things will just, you know, it's going to maintain the status quo. Wealthy people will get all the tax breaks. Wealthy people will have the first option to use whatever public property is available. I mean, I'm waiting for the wholesale sale of a lot of these public properties that belong to the residents of the city to be sold to developers to build more buildings at retail. Why, if you even go through Georgetown, you see businesses in Georgetown closing down because the retail markets are collapsing.
There's an empty retail building, retail front storefront right here, several of them, back to back to back.
Well, there's even a parking lot over here in this shopping mall that the city pays $100,000 a month for, that was supposed to deal with the parking problems of this community once they built this mall here, and nobody uses the damn thing. But, you know, you could talk about millions of dollars in waste in this city. I'm surprised that $68 million walked out of the tax revenue office. How come the CFO still got a job?
This was, $42 million or something, more than $40 million in tax breaks for this mall that's across the street from La Casa?
Something like that, yeah.
Any final thoughts you want to share, Brian Anders?
Well, I go back to a person I worked with in the 80s, Mitch Snyder, when we were a part of the CC&V community. And one of the things that Mitch would always say when people asked him, you know, what do you want us to do when we approach a homeless person? I think it's important that we begin to acknowledge the fact that we have a serious critical problem here. And the only way to do that is for people to stop ignoring the fact that you have homeless people in your community. Stop ignoring the fact that you're being told this myth that all these people are getting housing. Start to pay attention to what's going on with these folks in your communities, whether it's homeless folks, persons with AIDS. We've got to figure out a way to do some consciousness raising in this city. I don't know if we do that through the churches. I'm not sure how we're going to create that process. But we have got to start to look at the homeless folks as a part of our community, as a part of our society. And we cannot continue to ignore the fact that in this city, 23,000 people have no permanent place to stay. Affordable housing stocks are being eroded. Every vacant space does not require someone to build a building. And the fact that we can make commitments, and our city government officials, after good faith efforts, after dozens and dozens and dozens of testimonies, written documentation, promises made, can continue to deceive people by saying, yes, I feel your pain. Yes, I'm here for you. Yes, I support you. Because the one thing that Jim Graham seems to forget is that all the residents here who are getting pushed out of this building are also residents of Ward 1, and they are as much his responsibility as the people who live a half block down the street toward 14th and Irving.
I just thought of one more question. It's a little personal. At one point, you were homeless, and I thought back to your Vietnam service. Mm-hmm. And this weekend at the One Nation rally, I talked to some soldiers from IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War, who are launching a campaign to stop the reenlistment of soldiers who are on psychotropic drugs. One of five people reenlisted are. And I was wondering if you could talk a minute about your own experiences, as well as the effects of war that are going to leave so many people who are unable to re-enter society right away and are going to end up on our streets possibly.
Well, it's ironic that you would talk about that, because the growing number of these men and women who are coming back from both Iraq and Afghanistan since the economy has collapsed are beginning to find themselves homeless as well. Numbers in the VA are kind of askew, but we figure there's anywhere between 25 to 40,000 men and women who served in the military in the last 10 years who are now living on the streets due to the fact of the collapse of our economy. And it's a similar situation where you have people who serve their country, same as I did when I was in Vietnam, and then you come home and the support services that you need don't exist. The mental health care that you can ask for is sparse. Follow-up is very difficult. But you also begin to see there are a lot more people who are coming back with extreme problems with depression, violence, psychological issues, life-changing injuries, who really just don't have any support network, don't have any support services. And when you come back after spending 2 and 3 years on the deployment and your job is gone, although your job is guaranteed if you're in the National Guard, what do you do? If you are hearing voices, and you're fighting these wars in urban areas, when I fought in Vietnam, we were in the jungle. If you hear an ambulance or you see a cab, you go back to that same exact moment that you saw that when you were in combat. So a lot of these folks are not only traumatized in the war zone, but when you come back to the States, you're dealing with rejection, you're dealing with lack of services, you're dealing with the lack of support, you're more isolated. And when you're on the streets, it makes it even doubly more difficult for you to move into independent living, because everything that you need, like this building, if this building had been renovated, could have been used as a resource to help move these people forward. But when you're losing what little bit of support you have, you just begin to give up. And when you give up like that, you fall apart emotionally, you fall apart psychologically, you lose hope, you lose sense of who you are, you lose sense of yourself. And people that serve our country deserve better. The people who are born and raised in a city who are homeless deserve better. But it's going to require some compassionate thinking, some critical thinking, some honesty, and some objectivity. But more importantly, it's going to require some inclusiveness, and someone's going to have to spend the time and energy to listen to what the people are saying and what they're asking for, and create some sort of bridge between the people who can provide the money and the support and the services, and the desires and the needs from the people who just need a little help to pick themselves up, just a little bit, a little handout to help move them forward. And we live in the most powerful city. I mean, whole nations' decisions and futures are all decided on Capitol Hill. We can decide the fate of a country where half the people in the world couldn't find it on the globe. But in our own backyard, we ignore this horrific situation, and we exacerbate this problem through government inability to just be honest, to be compassionate, and to care. It's just a tragedy.
Thanks, Brian Anders.
Thank you.